Good evening, everyone. My name is Ron Thorpe. I'm Vice President for Education at WNET Channel 13, your public television station. And I want to welcome you all to this current installation of our author series. On behalf of Jim Tisch and our Board of Trustees and our President Neil Shapiro and all of my colleagues at WNET, thank you for coming out tonight. I also want to thank our partners, the New York City Society Library, a true New York treasure that's been our partner in these author programs for many years, and we look forward to many more in the future. The size of the crowd tonight, and I can almost see you, really is representative of the incredible buzz that is everywhere today about Cleopatra, A Life. I cannot remember a book that has been so universally praised in so many places at one time. And I have been reading these reviews carefully just to see if I could find just one little thing that someone has to criticize the author about. It's been extraordinary. And those of you who get the Sunday Times know that this last week, the cover book of the Times Book Review is Cleopatra, A Life. So we have got this stunningly important author at exactly the right time. We couldn't be luckier. So my connection to Stacy Schiff actually goes back to 1977. She doesn't even know about this. I was a young teacher at a boarding school in Andover, Massachusetts, called Phillips Academy. And when you are a teacher, at least in those days, at a place like Andover, you don't just teach, and I was a Latin and Greek teacher of all things, appropriate maybe for tonight. You run a dormitory, you coach sports, and in my case, I also worked in the admissions office. And my particular job was to admit the 11th grade class, the people who were coming just for 2 years. Now, this is kind of a daunting task, because it is the hardest class to admit, because at a school like Andover that is very competitive, an 11th grade kid has to not only be proficient in a whole lot of things, they have to be so together as a person that they're going to hit the ground running. These are not kids who can afford to have their 11th grade transcript look like a shambles. So you have to look for very special qualities in who you admitted to that class. And it was a small number of people who were admitted, a large number who applied. One of the students who applied from a little town called Adams, Massachusetts, for the 1977 entry class was a skinny little kid named Stacy Schiff. Stacy arrived at Andover next fall, and one of the things that we advise all 11th grade students is to not take the U.S. history class as 11th graders. History 35, as it has been known for decades on that campus, is the test of a student's academic prowess. And 11th graders who are new to the school are not ready to take it. So we advise them not to do it, and those who take the advice were happy. And those who didn't take our advice were usually very sad. Stacy Schiff not only talked her way into taking that class as an 11th grader, she convinced no lesser force than Nancy Sizer, who was the wife of the then headmaster, Ted Sizer, both of them historians, both teaching U.S. history, that she was ready to take this class. And Nancy did everything she could to convince her not to do that, but Stacy did it anyway. Now, I have to tell you that Stacy did not earn an A in that class. She did not earn a B or even a C. Stacy Schiff earned a grade that Andover gives very sparingly. It is a grade above A. It is a grade that recognizes work that is such a high level that A doesn't do it. That was Stacy Schiff, as a 16-year-old. So should it be a surprise that her career has wound out the way it has? Now, let me tell you one other little story, because I called Nancy Sizer last week, and I said, I'm introducing Stacy at this reading, and I just need a little something. So she told me the History 35 story, and then she said, now, here's something else you need to know about her. She organized a group of girls to apply to live in our house senior year. So the headmaster's house, which was always a bustle, of course, anyways, she said, in our 9 years at Andover, it never bustled like the year Stacy and her girlfriends lived with us. And she said, I want you to tell this audience that this young woman is an incredible ringleader. But she was always a ringleader for the good and the fun. Stacy has gone on all these years. She's kept close to the Sizers. We lost Ted a year ago, but she just had dinner with Nancy here in the city not too long ago. This is the kind of person she is. She left Andover, went to Williams. You've read all the credentials on the cards. She started out then she was a senior editor at Simon & Schuster, then decided to write her own books, and her very first one was a finalist in 1995 for the Pulitzer Prize. She got it on the second try in 2000, the book on Vera, Nabokov's wife, famous biography that she wrote. And then she went on to tackle Benjamin Franklin in France. Now, her current book, Cleopatra, is trying to do what 2,000 years of history has tried to bury. If Helen was the face who launched 1,000 ships, Cleopatra launched 1,000 myths, and we have all bought into them until this book. How do you think so much like an historian that you can bring to life Alexandria of that period, a woman for whom we have only one word that she ever wrote, no biographer who lived within 100 years of her life, and all these myths? How do you bring that to life? If you've tried to read the book, the first thing you're going to notice is it's almost impossible just to get the family tree right. The Ptolemies married each other's brothers and sisters and fathers and mothers, then they killed each other. It's impossible without a pen and a paper to keep these things straight. But Stacy Schiff has done it. It's my privilege to introduce to you now the author, Stacy Schiff.
Of an introduction, and then he made off with my remarks. And my History 35 paper will be on sale in the lobby after the talk. And just speaking as a biographer, I'd like to make clear the dates are off. I'm not as old as you said I was. Thank you for coming out. Thank you for listening to my past. A few years ago, a very wise writer defined biography as the revenge of the little people on the big people. And as subjects go, they don't get bigger than Cleopatra. She belongs to that exclusive club of historical figures whose names we universally recognize, even if we know next to nothing about them. Few women rival her in history or in legend. Think Delilah meets Catherine the Great meets Jackie O. So here is the ultimate collision of women and power, a brew of sex and celebrity. But on the other hand, what we know of Cleopatra is twisted, contorted beyond recognition. And the record is scant, to say the least, about which more in a few minutes. I should say that on the paucity of material scale, I consoled myself over the last 5 years with the fact that Cleopatra was better documented than Shakespeare, if worse than Jane Austen, about whom biographies appear like clockwork every year. Let me say at the outset that I wasn't even sure this book could be written. From the biographer's point of view, Cleopatra is something of a Mount Everest. And for years, I'd had her in mind, but I just couldn't see a way to write a straight, traditional narrative of the life. She turns out, in retrospect, to have been on every list of potential subjects I made since 1999. At the time, though, the idea struck me less as biography than as paleontology. It was about bringing statues to life at best. We may live in the post-factual age, as someone recently asserted, but she lived in the pre-factual one. There is almost no such thing as ancient statistics, which is a little bit daunting for the biographer. So can you rescue a person who's dissolved into a puddle of myth and misconception? This was particularly problematic for me. I was used to knowing what my subject had had for dinner and fretted about before he fell asleep and what woke him in the night. I can tell you what Nabokov put on his wife's shopping list and which cheeses Ben Franklin ordered for his household. But here, all bets were off. The Nile is not even where it once was. It's 2 miles farther east. The geography of Alexandria has changed. The city is flatter than it was in Cleopatra's day. Everything has changed, the culture, the religion, the calendar. Don't even ask about prices. I mean, how to translate the cost of hiring a Thracian mercenary into modern dollars. You have to get used to counting backwards. Cleopatra was born in 69 and she dies in 30 BC. And you essentially check all preconceptions at the door when you enter the world of her dynasty, the Ptolemies. As Ron has pointed out, it's very difficult to write about maternity in a family where children routinely poison their parents and parents dismember their children. Over and over, mothers sent troops against sons, sisters waged war against brothers, and hacked apart their sisters. But let me put those little peccadillos in context for a minute. I was coming to this project from a book about Ben Franklin and his 8 years in France. Those are essentially the years of the American Revolution and the peace negotiation which follows. And for those years, the American documentation is 2.5 times greater than that for the rest of Franklin's life combined. And that's not counting the French materials. In Paris, Franklin was surrounded by a net of British spies, which was surrounded by a net of French spies. And as far as I can tell, each one of those men was paid by the word. Nothing was too trivial to be reported on, including Franklin's dinner menu and the state of his laundry, which I'm happy to tell you was impeccable at all times. You're meant to be feeling sorry for me right about now, by the way. Everyone who owned a pen wrote a memoir in the 18th century, and those who didn't appeared to own a newspaper. There were both official French newspapers and unofficial French newspapers, the reports of which reliably contradicted each other. I might add that John Adams, also in Paris at the time, appeared to own several pens, missed his wife dreadfully, and had little else to do but write about Ben Franklin, but that's another story. So what do you look for in a biographical subject anyway? Surely some kind of resonance is necessary. It is, after all, a kind of collaboration, if not necessarily a collaboration of two willing parties. There has to be something instinctively right about it. Sometimes you know you just can't marry a man who collects tiny metal military figurines, and sometimes you know you can't write on a particular subject. You're just not willing to be blind for 5 years with Milton, or depressed with Carlyle, or neurotic with Florence Nightingale, or in rehab with Lindsay Lohan. You hope to be able to approach your temporary alter ego with the intimacy of a lover, the even-handedness of a judge, and the awe of a child. The people we all know and those with whom we live, although of course neither you nor I, do all kinds of senseless and contradictory and counterproductive things. They make the same mistakes twice. You, the biographer, are meant to be clear-sighted, impartial, and unforgiving. You're meant to notice when, for example, a man writes the same letter to his mistress that he had written to his wife 13 years earlier. This is an especially unattractive quality in anyone, but particularly so in someone who will go on to establish a reputation as the country's most original prose stylist and whose name is Nabokov. So who would be the ideal biographical subject? He or she would have lived after the advent of photography. He would have been the star of his penmanship grade class at high school. He would thereafter write in English that positively sings. There was a lot of Lafayette that did not end up in my Franklin book for the simple reason that I could not read Lafayette's handwriting. And I was let off the hook mercifully by the great historian Peter Gay when I explained the problem I was having. And Peter said, clearly, you don't know Gay's law of history. What is that, I said. He said, if you can't read it, it didn't happen. It's a supreme advantage to have a quotable subject, at least to a point. I do pity the Oscar Wilde biographer. That seems to me like walking down the street behind a supermodel. The subject's papers should be accessible, but not too accessible, and ideally within a 3-hour drive from your front door. Some of them should ideally have materialized from a mold-proof attic months after you've begun your project. I should say, too, that it's an advantage if your subject lived under an authoritarian government. Repressive regimes keep excellent archives. And you want your subject to have had friends and confidants, each of them with photographic memories, who are still walking around but have not already talked to 15 prior biographers. You don't want the recycled stories. Those associates should not be legion. In other words, you don't want to have to interview every member of the 1969 NASA team. You want someone whose name rings immediate bells, but about whom we know not a good deal. You are not Bob Woodward. Investigative journalism is not your forte. Oh, and you also want someone who died young. Mozart, Keats, Pocahontas. And then once you've satisfied all of those rational criteria, you realize with a pang that you want something else too, something much more important in this person with whom you're going to spend 5 or 10 or 15 years. You want to like him too. Why Cleopatra then? Or put another way, why would a relatively experienced, predominantly sane biographer, who reads neither Greek nor Latin, having never taken Mr. Thorpe's classes, and who's happiest in a dusty archive, attempt a biography of a first century BC queen of whom not a shred of documentation remains? Perhaps most of all, I was startled by my own ignorance. Here was a woman whom we think of as Egyptian, but who was in fact Greek, whom we remember as beautiful, but who was, even in the classical accounts, much more notable for her charm and her intelligence than for her looks. Here was a woman whom we have somehow conflated with Nefertiti, a queen who lived 1,300 years earlier. Here was a woman who successfully ruled a rich and fractious country for over 2 decades, steering it through plague and war and famine. She's the only woman in antiquity who rules alone, whom we have reduced to a seductress, a siren, and a snare. And then there was the enormity of her position. Every bit of Egypt belongs to Cleopatra, from the wheat fields to the oil presses to the crocodiles in the Nile itself. Every person in Egypt works for her. She profits from everything grown or manufactured or sold in her kingdom. The end result was a treasury unmatched by any other sovereign. She was hands down the richest person, man or woman, in the Mediterranean. Hers was an astronomical fortune by Roman standards, and remember that everything we know about Cleopatra comes to us from officials of the Roman Empire. By those standards, even the eunuchs who waited on her were rich. Her father had traveled around Rome on the shoulders of 8 men and with an escort of 100 swordsmen. There's very little reason to think that his daughter interpreted pomp differently. Her palace was the most sumptuous in existence, all onyx and ebony, with gold ceilings and gem-studded walls. It left every ancient commentator at a loss for words, or so he would say, and then he would continue on for 30 pages. It's difficult to convey how that struck a Roman, since the Rome that we imagine, the monumental Rome of the Pantheon or the Colosseum, did not yet exist. In Cleopatra's lifetime, Alexandria was still the center of the world, the fashion capital and the seat of civilization. Hers was the city of automatic doors and coin-operated machines. It was a city in which subjects were discussed that would be forgotten for another 1,500 years. Lightning conductors, the value of pi, the idea that the earth was round, the latitude of Marseille. By comparison, Rome was a provincial backwater. Cleopatra travels from one city to the other in 46 to visit Caesar, and I've compared the trip that she makes from 18th century Paris to 18th century Philadelphia. And even stranger to a Roman, gender mattered less than competence in Cleopatra's Egypt, where women operated mills and owned lands and leased vineyards and divorced husbands and inherited equally, and essentially enjoyed rights they would not again enjoy for another 2,000 years. Arguably, Cleopatra had more female role models than any queen in history. She also had an education every bit on par with that of Caesar. She knew her Homer, her Aeschylus, her Euripides. She'd studied with the best tutors of the day. She essentially had been to the same elite institution of higher learning. And unlike Caesar, she spoke 9 languages. Now, as you already know, poisoning and assassinating relatives were Cleopatra's family specialties. She was the second of five siblings, born of parents who were brother and sister. Just to make the family tree perfectly clear, her great-grandfather was her great-grandfather three times over. He was also her great-great-grandfather twice. Don't ask. And in fact, I'm sorry that you had trouble with the family tree, because I was trying to say between the lines, don't even attempt it. But I guess I didn't make that clear. In any event, there are five siblings. Cleopatra's father, Auletes, leaves town when Cleopatra's eldest sister is a teenager, and she promptly usurps his throne. Needless to say, he has her murdered on his return. Cleopatra is 14, and she's next in line for the throne. On her father's death, she and her next younger brother, who's 10, ascend to the throne. Within 18 months, they are at civil war with each other. He will die in that contest, which leaves Cleopatra at 22 with two surviving siblings. By this time, Caesar has arrived on the scene. He will exile the surviving sister to modern-day Turkey. Within 2 years, Cleopatra will poison the brother, and later, as a favor to her, Mark Antony will arrange for the sister's murder. In other words, none of Cleopatra's siblings survives past the age of 20. She's the only one who will die on her own terms. Also, in other words, she gets very powerful Romans to do her bidding. I think I've now addressed the question of Cleopatra's grasp of strategy and her affinity for power. Now, of course, that brand of savagery was standard operating procedure, as Plutarch reminds us. As he puts it, it happened in the best of families. Monarchy was, he writes, an utterly unsociable thing. Had Cleopatra not murdered her siblings, they surely would have murdered her. And the fact that she is still alive at 21, when she meets Caesar in Alexandria, is testimony to her cleverness. And just to put that meeting in perspective for a minute, if you've seen paintings of it, or you remember your Elizabeth Taylor, you know that Cleopatra leapt out of a roll of carpet before Caesar. This was the original girl in a cake. But if you pull the camera back a little, you see several other pieces of the picture. First of all, it wasn't a roll of carpet, but it was a traveler's sack made out of some kind of sturdy material like canvas. And second of all, Cleopatra had herself smuggled into the palace out of necessity rather than for special effect. Her brother, this is during the Civil War, her brother is in control of the city. Both she and Caesar are at war with him, and her life was at stake. She needed to make her way behind enemy lines, along a river very carefully patrolled by guards, and into a palace that was itself barricaded. So she appears before Caesar to plead for her life and her throne rather than to seduce him. 9 months later, she has both her kingdom and his child. You can draw whatever conclusions you like about her methods. I should say, by the way, that Cleopatra had a remarkable tendency to get pregnant at very opportune times. She has a child with Caesar at just that moment when she needs to cement her alliance with him. And moreover, it's a son. It's the only son whom Caesar will have. And she was equally adept in her timing with Antony, with whom she has a set of twins and later a second son, all while his wife kept producing daughters. I can't account for this, although I do spend a certain amount of time in the book talking about ancient forms of birth control, some of it surprisingly effective. Nothing better reveals the conflicting tides of science and myth, enlightenment and ignorance between which Cleopatra lived than the literature on contraception. For each valid idea of the age, there was an equally outlandish belief. Crocodile dung was famed in its day for its contraceptive powers, and the time-tested ingredients for a morning-after pill were salt, mouse dung, honey, and resin. And then there was the much-lauded concoction of mule's kidney and eunuch's urine. I think I've now exhausted the subject. Someone asked me recently when I realized that this book could actually be written, and I answered glibly but not really inaccurately that I realized as much when I finished writing it. But there was one other moment in truth, and it was when I finally noticed that we had actual 2,000-year-old quotes from Cleopatra and that we could hear just a hint of her voice. And that's thanks to Plutarch for the most part. On the one hand, it pays to remember that Plutarch was writing a good century after Cleopatra's death. He is as far removed from her as we are from Ulysses Grant. But on the other, as a modern biographer recently reminded me, there were no tape recorders in the 19th century either. It goes without saying that quoted material is always approximate. And two, as I'd learned from Benjamin Franklin, even the most comprehensive materials can refuse to divulge their answers. From hundreds of linear feet of documentation, The inner life may still go missing. And documentation is not the same as revelation any more than information is the same as wisdom or accuracy the same as truth. 5 years in those miles and miles of Franklin papers, and I still can't tell you who the mother of his son was. I doubt anyone ever will. I knew there were questions that could never be answered, but I also knew that it had nothing to do with the millennia that separate us from Cleopatra. What went on between Virginia Woolf and her brother? How did Shelley die? What was Emily Dickinson's problem? Where is Jimmy Hoffa? None of these questions have answers either. In some cases, it's in fact because we have an overload of information. Too many accounts can spoil the truth. How then was it possible to write about her? Let me go back to that line of dialogue in Plutarch for a minute. It comes in a marvelous account of Cleopatra and Mark Antony out fishing on a sunny, carefree Alexandrian afternoon. Plutarch meant to use the incident to illustrate what he calls Antony's boyish pranks, but it offers something else as well. The most accomplished military commander of his day, Antony is unable to lure a single fish from the fertile waters of Egypt. This is humiliating. It's especially so when you have your girlfriend, the Queen of Egypt, at your side. And so Antony arranges for one of his servants to attach several pre-caught fish to his line. And these he triumphantly reels in one after another. The scam is not lost on Cleopatra. She's competitive by nature, and she has an impish sense of humor. So she arranges for all of their friends to come watch her highly skilled Roman friend the next day, when she also sees to it that one of her servants attaches an imported salted herring to Mark Antony's hook. This he pulls from Egypt's waters to peals of laughter. On the spot, she advises him to forget about his fishing. He should be attending to his real responsibilities. He should be off hunting for cities, kingdoms, and continents. She's sly and she's saucy, but there's something familiar in her tone. It's one known to every woman who wants her husband to do something heroic and helpful, like empty the dishwasher. I should say, too, that the holes in the story are, as always, very telling, often as revealing as the information that they allied might have been. One German historian has gone so far as to propose that Caesar and Cleopatra's trip down the Nile was, in fact, covered up by Caesar's men because it was so incriminating. Cleopatra is in Rome when Caesar is murdered. She's staying in his villa with their child, but it was in no Roman historian's best interest to expound on that relationship, conducted with no great discretion while Caesar's wife lived across town. And after his death, he's deified. There was definitely no place for an Egyptian queen in that story. Hence, there are two full chapters in my book on Cleopatra and Rome, both of them spun out of three lines of Cicero. Think of this then as deductive more than inductive, moving from the very great deal we know about Cleopatra's world to what it meant for a highly educated, very clever woman, ruling at an unstable time and sitting at an all-male table, twice in fact, in all-male military camps. So yes, there were terrific constraints. Did I miss the eyewitnesses, the documents, the portraits, the relics, the fairy dust? You bet I did. I especially missed the typewriters. From the biographer's point of view, civilization begins with the advent of the typewriter and ends with the advent of email. And it was lonely out there with just Plutarch, Suetonius, and Elizabeth Taylor. At the same time, great literature is about ambiguity, and it seemed to me that biography could afford to be as well. You can't demand order, even answers of the classical world, and arguably, you rarely can even when it comes to the human heart. But you can do a lot with Cleopatra's world, especially given the last 50 years of fine scholarship which have been devoted to it. Virginia Woolf once remarked of an imperfect novel that the string didn't quite unite the pearls, but that the pearls were there. And I took that as a sort of operating premise here. The other one was Julian Barnes's fabulous alternate definition of a net, which is a series of holes tied together by string. There were huge unknowns, but there were also known knowns. Among them, several critical subjects that no one had really explored before, like the extent of Cleopatra's wealth, or her relationship with Herod, or her education. Years ago, I interviewed David Herbert Donald, the great Lincoln scholar, and asked about his work. After all, he was working in one of the most closely mined fields in American history. Stacy, he said, there are rarely new answers. There are only ever new questions. Of course, I had one terrific advantage. Human nature is remarkably constant. It has changed not one iota since the first century BC. You can read Cicero on how not to spoil a rich child. A friend of one's friend was already one's enemy. Power was already an aphrodisiac. And you can read countless texts on how women are shrill and unbending in their demands, but loose in their morals. Already, wives came in two varieties: the scheming spendthrift wife, for whom no house is large enough and no diamond big enough, and the paragon of virtue who, and I'm quoting, loved her husband, bore two sons, kept the house, and worked in wool. Every problem Cleopatra had with Rome is the problem a woman in power faces today, with very little variation, if arguably better, birth control. The successful woman is sexualized, shrill, and unnatural. And when a woman sleeps with two of the most powerful men of her day, she is a seductress, even if both of those men happen to be celebrated for their voracious sexual appetites. So how we constitute and reconstitute history was on my mind all the way through as I wrote this book. There's, of course, always a central problem in writing history, which is that those closest to the events have the best information, but also the most at stake. The most informed source is, by definition, the most involved source. And the later chroniclers may know less, but they can say more. With each book, I've been well into the work when I realized that there was something utterly rudimentary that I had forgotten to research. With the Franklin book, it was the American Revolution. And in this case, it was that I needed to understand precisely who the men who left us Cleopatra's story were. I had ventured out to the desert where Cleopatra was exiled. I had soaked in the Alexandrian color, all before I realized that I needed to know my sources as well as I knew my subject. And of those who actually knew her and who wrote of her, there are only three: Caesar, who was married to someone else during his affair with Cleopatra, focused on Rome, and understandably reluctant to mention her, and Nicholas of Damascus, who'd been the tutor to Cleopatra's children, changed sides after her death, and became a close confidant of her sworn enemy, Herod. And lastly, Cicero, the statesman and great orator, who rarely had a kind word for anyone, love him for that. He had vexed relationships with women. He prided himself on his books. He found Egypt suspect. He was a dyed-in-the-wool Republican. He had very much disliked Cleopatra's father. He liked to be the quickest-witted person in the room. Intelligent women who had better libraries than he did offended him on three counts. So I tried to keep an eye throughout the writing on who was a sensationalist and who was a scold, who had set eyes on Egypt and who despised the place. Nearly all were Romans and officers of the empire. Many instinctively hailed from the school of Euripides, who wrote, "Oh, if only women were nowhere to be found except in my lap." Love that quote. I've tried to work the commentators and their personalities and their biases into the book while focusing primarily on the narrative. The idea was to tell a fast-paced story while leaving the necessary blanks blank and slaloming a little bit across the wake of the legend. From the French newspapers of Franklin's day, I knew the difference between propaganda and hearsay. And in Cleopatra's case, we owe a huge debt to both. Biased and inaccurate though they may have been, the Romans who left us her story did us a tremendous favor. Normally, women are very difficult to write about. They keep lousy records and their lives go undocumented. But Cleopatra owes her immortality to her enemies. She's one of the few women in history whose detractors have enlarged rather than erased her role. Had she been a man, she would have been forgotten today, like so many of the other sovereigns whom Rome eliminated. And for the record, had Rome not intervened, had Cleopatra been dealt a stronger hand from the start, she would have faced a different but no less vicious enemy. In the normal course of events, she would ultimately have been deposed, poisoned, exiled, or hacked to pieces by one of her own four children. In which case, you can very well guess what would have happened. We would never have heard of her at all. Thank you. I suspect there may be some questions. And I think I meant to ask you to go to the microphone, which I can't even see from where I'm standing. Thank you. Yes.
I have two questions. What drew you to Cleopatra, and why now?
As I say, she'd been on my mind for a long time, and the question was simply, could you write a book with this little material? And I think, to a large extent, the nexus of women in power was the real issue. I mean, here was a woman for whom, first of all, history is completely mangled. There are very few people whom we've mangled quite so effectively. And second of all, here was a woman who wielded power almost unlike anyone else. Maybe Catherine the Great is a comparison, but very few people who ruled as much territory and controlled as much wealth, about whom we know almost nothing. And her day-to-day life is possible to some extent to construct if you take the day-to-day lives of other sovereigns, in fact. So there was this sense that we've reduced her to something she isn't, and yet what she actually accomplishes in the 2 decades in which she rules Egypt must have been quite extraordinary. So there was really just a sense there of history having been completely mangled, and women in power had been so much on my mind for a long time, as I think it may have been for many of us over the last few elections, and I just kept seeing this as a perfect way to explore some of those issues to see how, if at all, they had changed. I think there was also I think there was always for the biographer a sort of anxiety of influence with the previous book, and I think having spent all that time in the Franklin archives, much of it in France, much of it still not deciphered, much of it moldy, all of it handwritten, I was really happy to work on a book where there were no materials. And where you didn't really have to leave New York.
Was your publisher enthusiastic about this book from the start, or did they need convincing?
Well, you sound as if they should have needed convincing. They were enthusiastic. Lord knows what they were thinking. They were very enthusiastic. I don't really know if I can explain why, but it was a blessed thing, very, very much so from the start. I think partly, we write about Cleopatra constantly. There's a book every year, if not several books. At the moment, you may have noticed, there are 3 of us writing about Cleopatra. And I think that the idea that a woman was writing about Cleopatra and actually trying to reconstruct her from the evidence was very compelling to them. I also think it was a publisher I had not worked with before, and I think there was always a sort of, what can this girl bring to the table? What's fresh here that we haven't seen before? It's very odd, but she tends to change a lot. Cleopatra tends to change a lot with the times, and one of the best books which I had looked at among sort of the last 100 years of secondary sources was a very good book from I think 1939, maybe 1938, which factually is impeccable. But every couple of pages, there's a tribute to the fact that Cleopatra was clever and powerful. But alas, she was a woman. So there was a sense, really, of being able to dust her off and do something different with her, which, for whatever reason, enthused the publisher.
It'll be obvious that I haven't read the book yet, but did you...
You're not meant to have. You're meant to buy several copies now.
I will. Was there any? Did you find anything about what kind of a mother she was?
It's a great question. I just wrote an article about that, but I'm not sure I know the answer. She, as you know from what I've said, she had 4 children, and they are very well educated. They are educated by essentially the best tutor money could buy, so to speak. He goes on to become, it's Nicholas of Damascus, to whom I alluded, goes on to become the tutor to Herod, who's always very aware of the fact that his education is insufficient and that he's not as polished a sovereign as is Cleopatra and several other of the other sovereigns of the Greek world. And he is a slave driver of a tutor, and he is the tutor to Cleopatra's 4 children. So we know that they're both the daughter and the sons are very, very well educated. And we know that she gets a tremendous amount of mileage out of having children. I mean, it is not only that she has them at very opportune times, it's that and manages to cement political alliances with them. It's that as the Queen of Egypt, who comports herself as a goddess and who has associated herself with Isis, who is more or less a fertility goddess, it's essential that she have children. And so the fact that she has a child who turns out to be a son, which is highly convenient for another reason, which I'll talk about in a minute, is immensely important for her in terms of being able to maintain her hold on the throne. A woman could rule Egypt so long as she had a man of some kind at her side. And it was really helpful to Cleopatra to have a 3 or 4 or 5 year old son at her side because he could really do nothing to mess with his mother's agenda. So on the one hand, he buys her the legitimacy that she needs in terms of having a male consort. On the other hand, obviously he's completely at her mercy. And she's very brilliant at managing this iconographically. On the walls of temples, you can still see them today, on the walls of the Temple of Dendera, she very smartly has Caesarion, little Caesar, preceding her. So she takes second place to him, even though he's 3 or 4 at the time that this this carving is made. But she uses the kids to tremendous advantage dynastically and iconographically throughout the reign. And they come in really handy, obviously, in terms of maintaining the alliances that she needs with Rome. The only downside, and it becomes rather an important one, is that after the death of Caesar, the world essentially will divide between Mark Antony, Caesar's great protege, and Octavian, who is posthumously adopted by Caesar as his son. And it becomes impossible, because Octavian is supposedly Caesar's son, for him and Caesarion to coexist. And so Caesarion becomes a political liability. And at one point I did say to a great Hellenistic historian, well, what if, you know, I don't deal with any what ifs in the book, but I did say, you know, what if she'd allied herself with Octavian? I mean, could that ever have happened? Because Caesarion was in the way. And he said, shrugging his shoulders, well, then she would have murdered Caesarion. So, you know, I think the answer to your question is, in many ways, a very strategically minded mother who always had her eyes set on maintaining the throne of Egypt, continuing the dynasty, and consolidating power within the family. Yes. Thank you. I knew nothing about a lot of things, but I knew nothing about the role of women in Egypt at the time. And it is utterly astonishing from what has been found. I mean, the evidence of women's independence, women inherit equally, they run businesses independently, they divorce, they get alimony payments, they're entitled to a house after divorce that their husband is meant to buy for them. It's an extraordinarily egalitarian society, which does, for which I don't have an explanation, but it does help you to understand how a queen could have achieved such power. Because there's such equality of the sexes. And I had no idea of that. It is staggering to Rome, and it's been staggering for generations. I mean, Herodotus writes about how backward a country Egypt is because the women seem to be in control. I mean, it's what could possibly be going on in a place like that? And and he gets this from an earlier source, in fact. So it tells you what a backward and paradoxical place Egypt is, that women seem to enjoy this incredible independence. But corollarily, there is every reason to believe Cleopatra would have had the same education as her siblings. And that, too, is mystifying to a Roman. There were very few Roman women who had the kind of schooling that Cleopatra would have had, Cleopatra and her siblings, her murderous siblings, would have had. But I had absolutely no idea of that. It seemed to me as if this would have been true, this elitism would have been true within the royal family, but I did not realize that it ran through Egyptian society as a whole. Stunning. It's really stunning. It's also frightening because you think, if this was true 2,000 years ago and then we lost it for 2,000 years, could we ever go back there again? But I'm not going there. Yes? I don't think you could vote under an autocrat, alas. You really didn't do anything except what your monarch told you to do. And I think that's what, the other thing that is staggering is the taxes, on which there's been a great amount written, the tax structure, and this was not something of Cleopatra's design, it predates her by several hundred years, the tax structure in Egypt was designed in every possible way to benefit the monarch. It was the people's role to fill the monarch's coffers, period. So that on most things, she profits doubly. I mean, a man who wanted to brew beer had to pay a tax on buying his yeast from the government, and then he pays a tax when he resells his beer back to the crown. So at every possible transaction, whoever is in power is essentially profiting, which accounts for the Ptolemaic fortune. It has diminished by Cleopatra's day, but because of the way that the thing has been set up, it's beyond imagining for the rest of the world. And it must have been staggering to a Roman for whom there was no bureaucracy whatsoever, whereas everything in Egypt is regulated, and all of it is regulated to make it lucrative to whoever is in power. Yes, sir.
Since Cleopatra was in Rome when Caesar was assassinated, Plutarch contends that Brutus and the other assassins killed Caesar to save the Republic. Was it also to prevent the queen from becoming a Macedonian Egyptian and the next heir to be half Egyptian?
We don't know. Cleopatra is never mentioned in any, I mean, the only account we have of Cleopatra being in Rome is from Cicero. And as you may know, Cicero has one real problem with Cleopatra, which is that she promises him a library book, which she never delivers. And for this, she has paid the price for 2,000 years. So return your library books is my advice to you. And don't mess with Cicero. But there's no clue. I mean, everything we hear about Caesar's murder has to do with how he's comporting himself like an autocrat. He has given no thought whatsoever to the problems of the political scene. He's off conquering. He's tone deaf. He's involved in his own projects. He's focusing on conquering Parthia. He's paying no attention to what's going on at home, and he is letting all of these honors rain down upon him in a very, like a Hellenistic sovereign. Now, he has just come back from Egypt and Africa, and he's seen how that works, and he has Cleopatra in Rome. So it does add up to my mind, and I don't go out on a limb on this in the book, but it does add up to my mind as if Egypt made an impression on him in some way. And he does bring back with him from Egypt a number of reforms, like the calendar reform, and like some of the engineering projects which have so impressed him in Egypt, which are new to Rome, which is, as I said, still very much a primitive world by comparison. But there's no proof that Cleopatra plays a role in this. It does seem to me that, yes, having an Egyptian queen living across town when you're being accused of carrying yourself as a king is not really a good thing to have. But there's no proof that she plays any role. After the murder, she flees very quickly. I mean, she has banked on Caesar. He is her white knight, her security blanket, her cohort in all of this. And her life is in danger. But we know nothing about how she got the news, what the fallout would have been, or what role she may have played in any of it.
Thank you.
Thanks. Yes.
Thank you very much for this talk. It was really wonderful.
Thank you.
You're an excellent historian and biographer working with a subject from whom there is little or actually no documentary evidence. At the same time, a very competent novelist, Robert Harris, is working with Cicero, from whom there's enormous amounts of first-hand documentary evidence, and he chooses to write a novel, or three novels. Were you tempted to write a novel and fill in some of the blanks way he has?
I'm tempted to be Robert Harris. I have.
Actually, we need you more than Robert Harris.
Maybe not. He seems to get read on airplanes more than I do.
Not the Roman books.
I have one problem, which is I have no imagination. So it would be very hard for me to write a novel. I will admit, so no, I was not tempted to do that at any time. And it's odd. I mean, a normal person would be tempted to do that. And I never found myself kind of going off into a speculative frenzy about anything. I mean, when people say, what would you most like to know? I think I would like to know, how did Cleopatra react? You know, she's up in Caesar's villa. It's midday. Caesar's murdered. Some messenger had to hustle up there really quickly to tell her what had happened. You know, how did she react? She's a very, very cool and dispassionate woman. She doesn't usually lose her head. She must have flipped. It's an extraordinary moment. So that's the one thing I would love to know. So had I an imagination, that's where I would start.
Well, Robert Harris would tell us.
I'm sure he knows, actually. But I will admit that when I got to Cicero, it was like, you know, finally a life vest. Finally there was a voice, because until that point, I mean, working with, you know, Cleopatra's early years, of which, I mean, childhood does not exist in the ancient world. You have to set up Alexandria. You have to give an account of her education. We know very little about the relationship with Caesar, because obviously Caesar doesn't write about it. But Cicero, I mean, suddenly you have a voice. And he did rather get carried away with my narrative. And I did have to do a lot of pruning to cut him out of the book, because I think at a certain point I realized I would rather be writing about him than about Cleopatra, because he, A, is so quotable, and B, he's so vile about everything. He's heaven. I mean, it's just, you know, he didn't have a kind word for anyone. It was a pleasure to spend time with him.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes. That's a really great question. I don't know, because there was always some sibling who managed to murder the other ones who was around to pick up the, to take over. Usually there was an aunt or an uncle. What happened with Cleopatra's father, in fact, is that he was not in line for the throne, and pretty much all of the obvious contenders, for various reasons, were out of the running. And he, who had been living abroad, was brought back and put back on the throne. He was actually, he was not the obvious next choice to become king. So there was always someone in the family whom you could call on. I mean, the interesting thing, because the Ptolemies intermarry, is it intermarry? They marry brothers and sisters. There's a very, very small number of people who were actually possible contenders for the throne. And so on the one hand, you consolidate power, and you eliminate all the sort of pesky in-laws. On the other hand, you have a very limited number of candidates for people who can actually rule. Sorry. Yes?
You mentioned in your book that Cleopatra, at age 21, was probably a virgin when Julius Caesar arrived on the scene. How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, did you notice that there's a big probably in that sentence? Yeah. For the following reason. She's married, she's nominally married to her younger brother, who's 10. And yes, I did research puberty ages during the class in the classical world, and it's unlikely he would have attained puberty by the age of 10. So that was my guess. I mean, the other problem with being a Ptolemaic princess was he didn't have a lot. I mean, there weren't a lot of guys you could date. There weren't a lot of possible matches, and especially in her sister's case, for example, people had to go to great extents to find someone who was a legitimate husband or consort for her older sister. You had to travel pretty far and wide to find someone who was, as with any dynasty, who was of the proper level and who had the proper heritage. So given the fact that Cleopatra from a very young age is ruling with her younger brother, I don't see that there could have been a lot of opportunity for anything else. There's a probably in that sentence, though, for that reason. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Stacy. That was a remarkable talk. It's a remarkable book. And I think about this question over here and what Robert Graves did to Suetonius and Plutarch and gave us I, Claudius, which was so helpful to public television. I hope maybe something will happen with Cleopatra. Thank you all for being here. Stacy will be signing books in the lobby right after this. Thank you.